Welcome to the Capital Connection, a weekly program questioning New York State leaders on a variety of issues. Your host is Dr. Alan Chartok, political scientist and professor emeritus at the University at Albany. Distribution for the Capital Connection is made possible with the help of New York State United Teachers, representing professionals in education and healthcare, online at nysut.org.
Hi, it's Alan Chartok, and this is the Capital Connection. Joining us this week is Chisun Lee, senior counsel in the Democracy Program at the Brennan Center for Justice, where she works on campaign finance reform and voting rights, and is the lead author of a new report that finds secret spending in the states is around. We'll talk to her about her work and much more, but first, welcome, Chisun Lee.
Thank you very much for having me.
Well, tell us about the secret spending. What's that about?
This is an investigation we did of so-called outside spending, which is the kind of spending by super PACs and nonprofit organizations that's really exploded since the Supreme Court decision, Citizens United, in 2010. And we wondered, what's going on at the state and local level, since so much of the focus on the issue is on federal elections? So we did a couple of things. We looked at spending and contribution records in states from before and after Citizens United to really see, have things changed, how so? And then we also scanned, essentially, local news reports around the country to see, on a more qualitative scale, what's going on, what kinds of elections, what kind of issues is outside spending affecting. And we were very surprised by what we discovered, even going into this study, expecting that things were going to have changed quite a bit. We were surprised to see how much outside spending in the states has become much more secretive between 2006 and 2014, which is the most recent state election cycle for which we could get data on states where they had the big elections, governor, top of the ticket. And this was not directly a result of Citizens United, because Citizens United, as you know, was about lifting limits on spending. It wasn't about saying that spending could be secret. But what it did was it incentivized a great deal more outside spending in elections, more super PACs, more donors putting money into outside organizations. And so we found we were able to get data that we could actually use from six states. And if I can talk later about why we still think that's a fair representation of the problem across the country. What we found was, overall, in 2006, people could find out who the original donor was for about three-quarters of outside spending. By 2014, that ratio had flipped so that in nearly three-quarters of outside spending, you can't tell from public disclosures where the money behind these outside ads is really coming from.
So let me ask you, what are the options in terms of correcting this issue? Can states pass individual legislation talking about, you know, more transparency? Could this be subjected to yet another Supreme Court case at the top? How do you see this being changed?
The good news findings in our study is that states and cities can do a lot to deal with secrecy in outside spending. One of the states that we were able to look at was California, which, of course, because of the size of its state and the size of its politics, has the biggest levels of outside spending. We're talking about $75 million in outside ads by super PACs and nonprofit groups at the lowest point we looked at. But California has remarkably little dark money, remarkably little money where the public can't figure out by looking at public disclosures where that money originally came from. It never got as high as $2 million, and this is out of $75 million in outside spending at the lowest point we looked at. And the reason for that, we think, looking at this, is California has some of the toughest transparency requirements in the country. If you are spending on an election season advertisement mentioning a candidate, you have to disclose the fact that you're spending, and you have to disclose the donations that went into that advertising. And it has one of the toughest enforcement agencies in the country that actually encourage compliance, because people know that if you don't comply, there's a good chance that California's elections agency is going to start asking some questions. So there are things that states and cities can do, and there are a handful of jurisdictions since Citizens United that have risen to this challenge and have seen just many millions more coming into their state and even local, you know, school board, city council elections, and they have started implementing reforms, whether it's legislative. There are some ballot measures where the voters themselves, such as in Maine last year, the voters said, we want to know who's funding these ads.
I was going to bring that up, Jason, because I think that that's terribly important. California, of course, has initiative and referendum. My state, Massachusetts, mm-hmm. has a version of that. I wonder, have you done any comparison between the ones that have voters actually having that final say, or states like New York, where you'll never get it?
Right. Well, it is true that some of the impetus around fixing some of these problems you're seeing play out in ballot measure proposals, and only in a few spots so far have ballot measures actually passed. So it's true that that is a more direct vehicle than going to the legislature for wanting campaign finance reform. But also, you know, interestingly, our study found that areas where ballot measures get a lot of policy done have also been the targets for a lot of this secretive outside spending, because as you know, in some areas, you know, voters will vote on ballot measures about labor organizing rights or the state sales tax or public education policy. And as you might imagine, there are some business interests and other interests where the outcome of these ballot measure elections is going to dramatically affect their bottom lines. And so you see a great deal of secret spending, by which I mean spending by groups with nice sort of generic names, you know, Americans for Better Tomorrow, that sort of thing, running ads saying, you know, vote yes on proposition what have you because it's good for families, that sort of thing. So ballot measures, there's sort of two sides to that coin.
Sure. There's no question, and that's always been the rap in California, for example, that some terrible ballot measures have been put up, which, you know, attract people and pass and then have to either be dealt with by the courts or other people. You're quite right about that. Talk to me a little bit, if you would, about the looming presidential election and what secret money may have to do with Trump versus Clinton.
Well, you know, this is another very interesting thing we found in our study. We're so used to thinking about the problems of money in politics at the presidential level. And to some extent, that makes sense because that's what everybody's paying attention to. But where it probably makes the biggest difference is in elections that fly well below the public radar, where your average voter maybe doesn't even know all the names on the ballot, mm-hmm. let alone know exactly where they already stand. In other words, when in the presidential contest, you probably don't need to see advertising by anonymous donors to know whether you're falling on one side or the other side of the aisle. But if it's an election for the state's utilities commission that governs electricity rates and other energy policies, and that's going to affect a homeowner's electricity bills, and it's going to affect companies' bottom lines, and you see six candidates who are running for two term-limited seats on that commission, and it's and often these races are nonpartisan, so you don't even have that signal telling you, okay, well, I'm going to vote R because that's what I always vote. That's where we found that advertising, and it doesn't even have to be television, it can be mailers, is supporting, you know, vote for these three candidates. They're going to be, they're more conservative on business and, you know, they're going to help grow the economy. That's where we found that anonymous advertising can really have the greatest impact, because at the presidential level, a lot of people already know what they think.
They know what they think, and yet there are still these outside, you know, groups who are supposed to not be coordinating with the presidential candidates themselves and therefore have tremendous potential to operate with the kind of secrecy you're talking about, don't they?
Well, That's absolutely a problem. And we did a similarly big study on this a couple of years ago that identified how huge a problem it's getting to be. And in fact, such a widespread problem that that people now talk about it as if it's normal, where you have candidates for high-profile federal offices, and a lot of the coverage around their candidacy is, you know, do they have their own super PAC yet? But as you correctly point out, federal law requires a separation between a candidate's campaign and super PACs. They're not supposed to coordinate, because once you coordinate, all that unlimited fundraising and spending going into the super PAC is supposed to be treated as campaign contributions, and then those are subject to quite reasonable limits. And that's become so much a part of the new normal that I think the bright line that the Supreme Court majority imagined when it ruled on Citizens United, that problems of corruption and so forth are not going to happen if you allow super PACs to have unlimited spending power, because of course they're independent from candidates. When you look at what's happened in the years since and you look at the reality of money in politics, you can see that that bright line that the Supreme Court imagined really is unrealistic. And we need a change in the law at the Supreme Court, and we need enforcement agencies and rules that actually work. And as you all know, the Federal Election Commission is hamstrung in actually enforcing what rules do exist to stop coordination between candidates and outside groups. And I agree that it's a problem.
So the Brennan Center, famously, maybe the most famous thing they ever said, although they're a very important institution, said that New York was the worst legislature in the country, the most corrupt, I think, in the country. This program is often devoted to New York state politics. So I wonder, what are your findings in New York?
Well, New York was not one of the six states where we looked at actual campaign finance records over these three cycles. So we don't have findings specific to New York there, but we have been working on money and politics reform in New York State generally from a couple of other angles. And I would say what we know is that, in a way, New York has more work to do even before we can start talking about disclosure of its super PAC and nonprofit ads. I'm sure that you're familiar with the LLC loophole problem.
Indeed. And why don't you remind everybody what it is? But of course, you know, Governor Cuomo, who takes a lot of that LLC money, has been forceful in his admonition of it and says that, you know, he wants it changed. But somehow, I don't know why, it doesn't get changed. Can you explain what it is to people who still may be uninitiated about it?
Sure. And again, it's a widespread practice, I think, you know, across the aisle. But LLCs, as you know, they're limited liability companies, and they're a creation of corporate law, essentially, that's supposed to enable people to do business more easily. The issue is that in our state, the Board of Elections has been treating LLCs as the same as people, as natural human beings when it comes to campaign contribution limits, and not treating them as corporations or business partnerships, which are subject to much lower limits. And we've argued that this is an erroneous interpretation, that an LLC is not the same as a human being. And in the state, as you know, the contribution limits can be very high for individual people. You can give it as much as $65,000 in a cycle to a statewide candidate. And, you know, you can multiply that across offices, and you imagine how much influence a donor can have. And at the moment, LLCs are able to do that, except that a person can create an infinite number of LLCs and give that way. So you can imagine how much bigger the scale of giving can get. And we've argued in court, we're currently litigating this, and we've argued publicly that that makes no sense, and that's not what our campaign finance law is supposed to do, that this is an erroneous interpretation of campaign finance law, and LLCs should be treated the same as corporations, because our legislature realized that corporations needed to be subjected to more stringent requirements. They can just simply amass more wealth because they're businesses, and LLCs pose much of the same problem, and they pose an additional layer of secrecy problem, because it is sometimes almost impossible to find out who is actually behind an LLC that may also have a very nice neutral name or a meaningless name. It could be named after a street address, and you have no idea who the individual or business interest is behind that LLC.
Well, of course, look, Chi-Sun Lee, you are a brilliant investigator of this issue. We know this. So I'm going to ask you a question, and then if you don't want to answer it, okay. But clearly, legislators have it in their interest. That's how they got there, using this, and they're using it increasingly to get sort of bought and sold, in my mind. My mind, I said. And therefore, what would the incentive for their changing the law be? You know, there's a lot of palaver about it. The governor says, as I said before, he's for it, but he takes their money. So why would anybody really in power want to change it?
Well, I think that a lot of what we're seeing this year with the various prosecutions and scandals in our state is that the public is really reaching a level of great dissatisfaction and skepticism about our elected officials. And people in office have to realize that once you lose the legitimacy of the folks who voted you into office, then really the purpose of your serving in that office is greatly undermined.
Yeah, yeah. But that's all very good. Should, schmud, all the rest of it. But we know that in this past legislative session, when they had a chance for some real significant ethical reform, they didn't come close to touching it. So you say they should, they realize what their office is, but they don't. It's all about winning.
Well, I think, you know, there are some folks who continue to push. I understand what you're saying. One reason that we have gone to court over the LLC loophole to argue that it needs to be interpreted correctly is in part because we think that there needs to be a legal solution to something that, as you said, has been a very difficult political problem.
You've been in politics for a long time. Give us a little bit of your history. You worked for the Public Advocate, didn't you, in New York City? You know, you're not what we call up here a goo-goo, somebody who is, you know, just academically interested. So how disgusted are you personally?
Well, first of all, I haven't been in politics a long time. I've been certainly
around
interested in following New York City and state politics. That's right. That's right. I haven't actually been in politics myself.
No.
And I am very concerned as a resident of the state with a family, and obviously what I do for a living is to fight every day for a stronger democracy where every voter actually has a voice in who's elected and what policies that that person brings to us. I am very concerned about how much money can go into the system from how few people right now with extremely little accountability. So we're working all the time to try and fix these problems a little bit here, a little bit there. There's the LLC loophole. We're fighting at this in the long term to change the law at the Supreme Court to enable states and cities to enact much tougher reforms. We're big champions of small donor-based public financing at the New York City level. It's been a successful program,
yes.
And we're always advocating to make it even stronger because we think that that's an alternative to the sort of highest bidder process in less regulated elections.
And yet Susan,
actually,
let me interrupt only because we're running out of time here, but let me ask you this.
Sure.
We see the United States Supreme Court come out with a very recent decision in which they say basically, we're going to leave an awful lot of room for politicians to get extra money on the outside, threatening both the Silver conviction in New York and the Dean Skelos conviction. And that has to be somewhat disappointing to you, doesn't it?
Well, I think that that's the widespread impact of that ruling has been overstated quite a bit in the coverage, because when you look at the decision closely, it's very tailored to the specific facts of that prosecution. And I'm not actually intimately familiar with all the details of the allegations in that case.
And yet eight to nothing. And Robert's describing it as distressing or disgusting. I don't remember the exact word he used. But,
right. I think I would emphasize very much that it is a ruling very specifically tailored to that particular case with a particular set of facts that went before the Supreme Court. And, you know, they laudably, especially in criminal cases, try to tailor their decision very closely to the facts in that case. And I don't think there's any reason to think that the decision, based on the facts in that particular case, are going to apply, therefore, to any other prosecutions in our state or in other states where the facts may be very, very different. The evidence may be much stronger. You know, so I think that it's hard to extrapolate from that ruling to say that's it for, you know,
silver and
number of prosecutions.
Look, you may be right, and I hope you're right. You have the brilliant U.S. attorney, Preparara, basically saying what you've just said. You know, we're confident that our case is going to work, that specific, we think we covered everything that's required of us. And yet, I think there's a general sense in the land that this opinion and others before it, in which quid pro quo became, you know, very important, that say, you know, there's a certain tolerance for the way politics are done in this country.
Well, I think that that general point is definitely one of concern. But I think what we find encouraging is that four justices that are still in the Supreme Court have, in those cases you're mentioning, dissented very strongly. They've disagreed very strongly with the majority about influence and access being at the heart of democracy, about narrowing the idea of what can be dealt with through reasonable regulation to simply bribery. There are four justices currently on the Supreme Court who are very concerned about how the court's previous majority, when the late Justice Scalia was with the majority, they're very concerned with the decisions that really enabled a lot of this outsized money in politics to enter our elections. So we are hopeful that a future Supreme Court, given good opportunities to weigh in on money in politics, we'll start to look at things differently. And we're working, and we hope and we know that many journalists are working on continuing to investigate the problem and putting out findings that can be cited to a future Supreme Court and say, look, this is what's going on. This is what has happened. And in fact, some of these past decisions are problematic and they should be overturned.
Well, you know, there are people who think Tinkerbell could be brought back to life. I don't see the way that it's going, giving you sustenance for that opinion. I don't want to be argumentative, but, you know, it seems to me that we got two presidential candidates, both of whom have been accused of certain ethical lapses over the years, being in charge. The American people don't like either of them. That's clear. And I think you've got a big row to hoe here.
Well, I think that, you know, one thing that we do find encouraging is that Citizens United and decisions like it all really happened in the span of a decade or less. So, you know, looking at it with that sort of historical perspective, it's quite possible to imagine how the law can be changed in the other direction in a reasonably short period of time. There were much more realistic, democracy-friendly decisions under Chief Justice Rehnquist's court, who could hardly have been accused of being a knee-jerk liberal. And so, you know, this has been a difficult short period for reasonable regulation of money in politics and protection of democracy at the Supreme Court. But there's no reason to think that it is a permanent situation now when it has not been in the past.
Our guest has been Chi-Sun Lee, senior counsel in the democracy program at the very well-respected Brennan Center for Justice. Chi-Sun, thank you so much for joining us. Your job is a lonely one, and I don't envy you having to do this. And thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
The Capital Connection is distributed with the cooperation of the public radio stations of New York State. David Gustina is the producer of The Capital Connection, a production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio in Albany. Support for The Capital Connection comes from New York State United Teachers, representing professionals in education and healthcare, online at nysut.org.